I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. President Trump repeatedly calls Robert Mueller's inquiry a witch hunt, and he continues to claim that the press is the enemy of the people. Is this unprecedented in American politics? No. An MSNBC podcast called Bagman reminds us that before he resigned as vice president, Spiro Agnew tried to impede a corruption investigation and leveled sustained attacks on the Justice Department, the press, and Democrats in general. Yogi Berra might have said, with Mr. Trump, is it deja vu all over again? Today, a conversation with Tim Baker, one of the U.S. attorneys who brought charges against Agnew, and Mike Yarvitz, the executive producer of the Bagman podcast. A story of pernicious corruption and courageous integrity. Lessons learned from Watergate, when Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome to a Snowmageddon edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. There is a winter storm warning in place until 7 o'clock tonight. The snow is predicted to kind of become snow and sleet in about an hour or so, sometime around 1 o'clock. Between 1 and 4, we'll have snow and sleet. And then perhaps that will be followed by rain or freezing rain after 4 o'clock today. The highs predicted to be around 33 degrees, east winds 7 to 9 miles an hour. They don't expect much ice accumulation today, and the total daytime snow and sleet accumulation could be 3 to 5 inches in the Baltimore metro area. Tonight, rain or freezing rain becomes all rain after 10 o'clock. The temperatures are going to rise. The low tonight, around 33, will have east winds just 5 to 7 miles an hour. They don't expect very much ice accumulation overnight. Tomorrow, rain likely until around 7 o'clock in the morning. We can expect some patchy fog before 10. Otherwise, it's going to be cloudy, and eventually the sun's going to come out, and the temperature will go up. We expect a high of about 48 degrees with mild winds 6 to 10 miles an hour coming out of the west. Their predictions for the accumulation of rain is less than a tenth of an inch, so there's not a whole lot there. But at the moment, it is snowing pretty heavily here in the Baltimore metropolitan region. It's expected to have even more snow north of the city. So if you are in the car, if you have to be in the car, drive safely. Stay a long way behind the person in front of you. If you're not in the car, we are delighted that you're listening to us here on Midday. Today, we're going to take a look at a crucial and surprisingly often overlooked chapter of fairly recent American history. The story revolves around Spiro Agnew, who was Richard Nixon's vice president until he resigned after pleading no contest to tax evasion and fraud charges. Agnew, of course, was also a Baltimorean. He was born and raised in the city, and he served as Baltimore County Executive and Governor of Maryland before being tapped as Nixon's running mate in 1968. And as we are deftly reminded in an MSNBC podcast hosted by Rachel Maddow, Agnew's resignation in October of 1973, which had nothing to do with the Watergate scandal, was still linked in a very important way to the resignation of President Nixon the following summer. The podcast is called Bagman. It's a terrific look at an often neglected part of America's constitutional crisis of more than 40 years ago, and it is redolent with reverberations to the current political moment. Several parallels between Nixon, Agnew, and Trump are unmistakable. Tim Baker was an assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland in the 1970s. He was part of the team of lawyers who investigated corruption in the Baltimore County Executive's Office, which set off a chain of events that eventually led to Spiro Agnew's resignation as vice president. Tim Baker is featured in the Bagman podcast, and he joins me here in Studio A. Good to see you, sir.
Good to be here, Tom.
And thank you so much for braving the elements. You drove from a little bit north of our studios here in Charles Village. How are the roads?
Slow but steady.
Mm-hmm. Are there many people out on them?
No.
Yeah, that's a good sign. All right. Well, we appreciate that you made yourself an exception to the rule and are with us today. Mike Yarvitz is an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning TV producer and the executive producer of Bagman, which he co-wrote with Rachel Maddow. Mike joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Not to rub it in, but just for kicks, what's the temperature like in L.A. today?
You know, I haven't checked it, but I think it's somewhere in the 60s, I'm going to say.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm not proud of being as jealous and envious as I am, but I am jealous and envious. So. But thank you for taking your time. And listeners, if you'd like to let us know what you thought of the Bagman Pat podcast, if you have listened to it. If you haven't listened to it, spoiler alert, we're going to talk a little bit about what's in it. So even if you get some of the tension taken out of it from our conversation today, it is well worth a listen. You can find it on the MSNBC website. Our number here at Midday, if you want to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, Mike, let me start with you. How did you get interested in this subject? And let's start by telling us what the term bagman refers to.
Well, bagman is a reference, as Tim can well elaborate on, to part of the scheme that Spiro Agnew took part in and carried out when he was Baltimore County executive and later governor and vice president. And it was basically an elaborate kickback scheme in which he was demanding kickbacks for contracts that he was giving out. And he was, as part of that, using a bagman as sort of a middleman, as someone who would take the money and deliver it personally to Agnew. And so This sort of bagman element of this story is one of the interesting and sort of intriguing elements of it, just in terms of how he carried out this operation.
And how did you and Rachel Maddow decide to pursue this as a story and as a podcast?
Well, I mean, we were looking sort of for precedents in terms of what we're going through today. And there's not a long history of presidents and vice presidents who found themselves under criminal investigation, federal criminal investigation. And so, you know, on that list is Spiro Agnew. And it seemed to us a story that is not entirely familiar to the American public and one that would be worth telling. It may be more familiar to folks who were in Baltimore and Maryland because it was in part happening there. But it seemed to be a story that was a bit overshadowed by Watergate at the time and you know, has a lot of these parallels that make it a relevant story to bring to people to understand today.
And Tim Baker, you are a big part of this story and a big part of the podcast. You served two stints, I guess, in the the U.S. Attorney's Office. When you began at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the early 1970s, you were by no means a seasoned prosecutor at that time.
I was young and a rookie. And I had the great good fortune to be assigned to work from day one with Barney Skolnick, who was young, too. He's older than I was, but he was much more experienced.
And tell us about the team. You had Barney Skolnick and then two other attorneys that you were working with.
Barney and I worked together and convicted a couple of Baltimore County executives, principally the executive of Prince George's County. And then when we started the Baltimore County investigation, Ron Liebman, who had been in private practice, came to the office and we recruited him to be the third member of our team when we started the Baltimore County Federal Grand Jury investigation in January 1973.
What led you?
Our leader was George Bell, who was the U.S. attorney, the late George Bell, who was a courageous, admirable, and wonderful boss. We all greatly admired him, and he did a terrific job.
So Bell was the boss of the whole thing. Skolnick was sort of the leader of your team with you and Mr. Liebman, right?
Right.
Yeah. And what got you interested in the Baltimore County Executive's office and the possibility of corruption? Did that come on a tip, or how did you get involved?
No, we had no tip, no witness, it was a total fishing expedition. It was based on this sort of street word that kept getting back to us. Some of it came from the Internal Revenue Service agents who work with us and who were not only magnificent, but absolutely essential. They're probably the only essential players in this whole story. We probably could have done it with other prosecutors, but we could not have done it without IRS agents. Anyway, we just kept hearing stuff. It's very amorphous, vague, And so we decided that we had a technique, we had a strategy, and we decided to go with a federal grand jury investigation, even though we had no allegations, no witnesses, nothing.
Yeah. And Mike Garber says you all started researching this story. It is a tricky thing to look into. I mean, we're talking about county executives, and then Spiro Agnew was one of a line of Baltimore County executives who took bribes to award contracts from the county. And then he kept doing it when he moved to the governor's mansion in Annapolis, and he kept doing it when he moved to the White House after he and Nixon were elected in 1968. However, he's getting literally envelopes full of cash delivered to his office by these bagmen. How does the IRS even know about that? How does anybody even know about that? Talk about an underground economy. This has got to be something that's going to have very little, very little of a paper trail.
Well, I mean, part of the really interesting aspect of looking into this story and, you know, part of the compelling reason to tell it was just to sort of go inside the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore, where Tim and Ron and Barney and George Bell were operating. And, you know, as Tim can tell you, it obviously didn't start looking into Spiro Agnew, as Tim is referencing. They sort of started looking into the issue of Baltimore County corruption. And, you know, I think Tim can elaborate it a bit more, but it seems like it was a Herculean effort by the IRS agents who were involved in the investigation to basically follow the money and to figure out, you know, these local architects and engineers were generating cash inside of their companies in order to pay off Spiro Agnew and, you know, it should be said, previous Baltimore County public officials. And so it was, you know, a meticulous effort, it seems, by these IRS agents to go through the books and to see where and how cash is being generated in the form of bonuses that are being paid to employees that are then turned into what becomes these cash payoffs that are put into envelopes. And so, you know, these IRS agents, along with Tim and Ron and Barney, undertook, it seems, a pretty impressive effort to figure out what was going on there. And ultimately, you know, that led to the man who was the sitting vice president at the time.
And Tim Baker, Spiro Agnew wasn't the first Baltimore County executive to have taken bribes, right? I mean, you prosecuted some others prior to Agnew taking office, right?
Well, county executives in other counties in Maryland, he probably wasn't the first Baltimore County executive to take bribes. He wasn't the last. His successor, Dale Anderson, who was the original target of the Democrat, who was our original target. We then found out that the people who were paying Dale Anderson had paid his predecessor, Spiro Agnew, and probably Agnew's predecessor. Memory of man runneth not to the to the time when this thing started. I think probably Anderson certainly inherited it. I think Agnew probably inherited it.
And the IRS then did have to look into the books of the companies.
If you want to pay bribes, you need $100 bills, untraceable cash. That's the medium of corruption. Well, if you're just a normal business, how do you generate thousands of dollars in $100 bills? Well, it's not easy. And furthermore, you don't want to do it obviously. So there are all kinds of ways that businesses use to generate the $100 bills. And skilled, dogged IRS agents going through all of the canceled checks from a company, all of the canceled check from their vice presidents and employees and subcontractors, they can find where suddenly it gets very suspicious. So what we would then do, the IRS would say, we need to talk to so-and-so. We'd call them in front of the grand jury and say, you generated a lot of cash here. What did you do with it?
And so you started investigating Dale Anderson,
right,
who succeeded Agnew as right. The Baltimore County executive. Agnew was only the third Baltimore County executive. I mean, this was a fairly new notion in Baltimore County government, even. You know, I mean, we tend to think this doesn't go back to the 1700s, this Baltimore County position of executive. So you find out that Agnew was involved as a county executive. And then was it your instinct that just said, well, if he was doing it in Towson, perhaps he's doing it in Annapolis?
No, the witnesses who paid him as county executive when he became governor, they thought this is, hey, wow, now we'll get state contracts. So they paid him as governor. And there were other people who paid him as governor. And then some of them continued to pay him when he became vice president or pay the bagman. Bagmen are a characteristic of bribery everywhere. And the reason is to try and insulate the public official who's ultimately getting the money. But what
it doesn't go directly from the briber to the bribee.
You pay the bag, give the money to the bagman.
There's a
the
middleman.
But one of the funny things that happens, it happens all the time, is people who are paying the bagman begin to get suspicious. Is the bagman giving the money to the public official, or is he keeping it? So sooner or later, they'll check it out by going to the public official themselves and asking. And once they've established that connection, they begin to pay them directly because they don't want the bagman to skim any of it.
Tim Baker was an assistant U.S. attorney here in Maryland in the 1970s, part of the team with Barney Skolnick and Ron Liebman, who investigated corruption in the Baltimore County Executive's Office, which eventually led to the resignation of Vice President Spiro Agnew. That is the topic of this incredible podcast produced by MSNBC called Bagman. Mike Yarvitz joins us from Culver City. He's the executive producer of the podcast, which he co-wrote with Rachel Maddow. We're going to talk more about it when we come back from a break. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Have you listened to Bagman? What do you think? Midday continues after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday on this snowy Wednesday here on WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, an update on the latest news from the Maryland General Assembly with Luke Broadwater. He covers the State House for the Baltimore Sun. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here to review The King and I at the Hippodrome Theater here in Baltimore. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about a terrific podcast called Bagman, which focuses on the fall of Vice President Spiro Agnew, who is, of course, Baltimore County Executive and Maryland Governor, before becoming Richard Nixon's VP. Bagman explores Agnew's crimes, his adamant condemnation of the media, his and Richard Nixon's attempts to impede the investigation into his wrongdoing, and the role that his resignation played in the larger constitutional crisis surrounding Nixon, who resigned in August 1974 to avoid his own likely removal from office. Mike Yarvitz is the executive producer of Bagman, which he co-wrote with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who hosts the podcast. Tim Baker was an assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland and one of the young federal prosecutors here in Baltimore whose work ultimately led to Agnew's resignation. Our phone number on midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. WYPR. So, Tim Baker, give us a sense of the time frame here when you started looking into Dale Anderson from that moment until the time that Spiro Agnew resigned in October of 1973. What are we talking about in terms of time?
Well, we started the federal grand jury investigation the first Monday in January 1973. And by the end of January, we had some witnesses who told us they had paid Anderson. Nobody mentioned Agnew, and we weren't thinking of him. We didn't get evidence of Agnew until late April, early May. And then it just started pouring in because witnesses who had paid Anderson, we wanted to make deals with, plea bargain deals, to testify against Anderson. And they were holding out. And the reason they were holding out was because they had this bombshell that they had also paid Agnew. But we kept pressuring. You know, there were all kinds of ways. The pressure was finally just overwhelming. They were either gonna talk to us, or they were gonna go to jail for a long time because they had committed serious tax felonies.
So we're talking about really basically like a 10-month span here, right? January to October. That's relatively fast as these investigations go, isn't it? I
mean, well, the investigation, if we had to go to trial, the investigation would have gone on for a number of more months. Mm-hmm. But when Agnew decided he was scared to death of going to jail, so he instituted plea bargaining discussions with Elliot Richardson, the
attorney general.
Talk about being lucky. We had the best attorney general maybe in the history of the country as to work with. Supposing we'd had John Mitchell, who's probably the most corrupt attorney general.
Yeah, of course, he went to jail for his role in the Watergate scandal.
Supposing he had been there, he'd have tried to deep six this.
Yeah. One of the things that really comes out as we listen to this podcast is the many parallels between the rhetoric that Spiro Agnew used and the rhetoric that Donald Trump uses to talk about the media or the Department of Justice or this, that, and the other person. Let's listen to a little clip from the podcast. This is a clip from the first episode.
Ultraliberalism today translates into a whimpering isolationism in foreign policy, a mulish obstructionism in domestic policy, and a pusillanimous pussyfooting on the critical issue of law and order.
Spiro Agnew doesn't exactly loom large as a political figure in U.S. history. His name barely registers as a political trivia question these days. But when Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew won the White House in 1968, Spiro Agnew, even though he doesn't get the credit for it, he basically created the mold for the modern iteration of confrontational conservatism in America.
But you know how it is with the radical liberals. You zing one of them and call his hand, cite his voting record, quote his speeches, tell America the harm he's done, and he howls like a coyote with his tail caught in a snake hole.
And Mike Yarvitz, you're the producer of the podcast Bagman. You can't imagine Donald Trump perhaps using the word pusillanimous or the term pusillanimous pussyfooting. But even before Trump, this sort of the conservative rhetoric and the conservative shtick, as it were, that grew through talk radio and that kind of thing. It really the roots of that perhaps can be traced to Spiro Agnew.
Yeah, Spiro Agnew really pioneered a lot of that rhetoric in terms of going after liberal elites, he gave a very famous speech in Des Moines, Iowa, in which he really attacked the media, the press, and part of the way that it sort of manifests itself eventually when he finds himself under criminal investigation is these efforts to basically attack the press for leaks, attack the prosecutors for leaks, and sort of try to sow distrust in the media and in his own Justice Department, which, you know, certainly has some parallels to today. And the prosecutors who were on the case, including Tim, Spiro Agnew, when he found himself under investigation, he sort of did a lot to try to, undercut their credibility, their legitimacy, their professionalism, which, you know, we certainly see parallels with in what's happening today.
And not only did he try, but to a large extent, he succeeded. He had a great deal of support. He was a darling of the Republican Party at the time in the way that, you know, Donald Trump, I mean, the latest poll numbers, you know, indicate that still some 85% of Republicans, at least, you know, support Mr. Trump and are ready to buy his assertion that the media is the enemy of the people and the Justice Department is full of corrupt naysayers. Let's go to the phones to Richard in Lockhearn. Richard, welcome to Midday with Tim Baker and Mike Yarvitz.
Good evening. Good afternoon. It's a little bit off topic. I've heard. I think it was on Fresh Air that talked about this podcast, and it was just interesting that when talking about Agnew, no one mentions, or it's rarely mentioned, that he was elected governor of Maryland because he was running against a much more conservative Democrat named Mahoney, who was actually rather racist, actually.
Yeah, it's a good point, Richard. And Mike Yarovitz, how did Richard Nixon come to choose Spiro Agnew then, who was this relatively unknown governor in Maryland, as his vice president? As you say in the podcast, he wasn't necessarily Nixon's first choice.
No, he wasn't Nixon's first choice, and it was a political marriage of sorts that was made in part by a young Nixon aide named Pat Buchanan, who was attracted to the political brand that Agnew had. Later, you know, sort of as he became governor, his response to the riots in Baltimore that took place after Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, Agnew, as you can see in some of the language in his response to that, had a political brand as it related to civil rights that became attractive to Pat Buchanan, which he then relayed to Richard Nixon as sort of an effort to win over Southern voters in that 1968 election. And so Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew didn't have a personal relationship with each other, but it was sort of a marriage of convenience in terms of what Nixon needed to win that 68 election.
And Tim Baker, there perhaps aren't rhetorical parallels between Spiro Agnew and Donald Trump, but there's certainly, in terms of PR, strategic parallels. But there are also some parallels when it comes to both of these men's inclination to try to impede investigations into them.
And attack investigators. One of the things that Agnew did and that Trump is doing is continually attack and try and undermine the credibility of the Department of Justice. Agnew went after us personally. Barney Skolnick had worked in Senator Muskie's office, and he said that was evidence of his radic lib bias. And he found in my record back in the closet of this scandal, protect your children from this, people. He found out that I, as evidence that I was a radic lib, that I had been a Peace Corps volunteer. And he thought that established my credentials as a commie. One of the things that I resented then and resent today is as a person, a man who has spent a number of years in federal law enforcement and have great pride in having been a part of the Department of Justice in several different capacities, is I hope the new Attorney General William Barr will stand up for the many dedicated, hardworking, highly competent and skilled professionals in the Department of Justice who are continually under attack by this president and this White House. Part of his job as Attorney General is to defend them.
And Mike Yarovitz, there were some revelations about the ways that Mr. Agnew and Mr. Nixon as well tried to impede this investigation that weren't even known to Tim Baker and Barney Skolnick and Ron Liebman that were revealed in the course of this podcast. Tell us the story, for example, of George Beall's brother. The Beall family was a very politically connected family here in Maryland, and we should mention they were Republicans, not Democrats, just FYI. But how was Mr. Beall's brother, Mr. Beall was the boss of the operation in the Maryland U.S. Attorney's Office, how was his brother involved in this?
Well, one of the things that we found in sort of researching this story was, you know, taking a look through the old Nixon White House Oval Office recordings, which, you know, a lot of people have sort of looked through in terms of the Watergate scandal. But when you listen to them, you hear this elaborate effort that Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon were concocting inside the Oval Office to obstruct the investigation that was happening in Baltimore. That was being led by Tim and Barney and Ron and their boss, George Beall, the U.S. attorney. And what they zeroed in on in terms of trying to impede that investigation, obstruct it, shut it down, was this effort to send messages behind the scenes to George Beall's brother, Glenn Beall, who was the Republican senator from Maryland at the time. And as you listen to these tapes, you can hear them strategizing, Agnew and Nixon, and also Al Haig, about getting to Glenn Beall and having Glenn Beall get a message to George Beall, the U.S. attorney, to get more involved in the investigation, to shut it down, to exert influence, and to basically stop this investigation from going to a place that they didn't want it to go. And one of the things that we were able to reveal in this podcast was that part of this effort to get to Glenn Beall involved the Republican Party chairman at the time, who was a man named George Herbert Walker Bush. And you can hear Nixon and Agnew in the Oval Office strategizing about having Bush send a message to Glenn Beall, the senator, to get word to his brother, George Beall. And one of the things that I think you're alluding to here that was very interesting is that all of these years later, Tim and Ron and Barney, who were working on the case, they were unaware that that scheming was happening behind the scenes. And the reason is because their boss, George Beall, who was, in fact, getting this pressure to shut down the investigation, he never relayed the pressure that he was getting to Tim and Ron and Barney. And so one of the things that we were able to do in this podcast was to sort of show them the transcripts of these conversations that were happening in the Oval Office between Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon that was about their investigation and about shutting it down.
What was your reaction when you read those transcripts, Tim?
Really startled and surprised. And also not surprised at George Beall's performance. George was a terrific U.S. attorney, and he protected us. I don't know what kind of pressure his brother put on him. His brother may have just simply informed him that these approaches were being made. I really doubt that he actually tried to pressure George. But whatever happened, George completely shielded us so that we were free to run, and which is what we did.
So in retrospect, I mean, would it have mattered? How would it have mattered if George Beall had said to you guys, hey, by the way, I'm hearing from the chair of the Republican Party.
Boom. We weren't career people. We were going to be in the Department of Justice for 2, 3, 4 years and then leave, maybe come back later, as I did. But that would have sparked a rebellion, probably a very public rebellion. That wasn't going to happen. That would never have happened with George. Never. If there any pressure, but he'd have been part of the rebellion. He'd have been leading it.
Yeah, and Mike Yarovitz, the decision to enter into a plea bargaining agreement with Spiro Agnew and to ultimately allow him to resign was a difficult decision to make. What was the calculus at the time? Agnew did not go to jail for these crimes. We'll talk a little bit about the consequences that he did face because of his long history of corruption. But he left the vice presidency, and what was Elliot Richardson and the Department of Justice figuring out, and how were they calculating what they wanted to do ultimately in this case?
Well, that's a fascinating part of this whole story, which is the role of Elliot Richardson and the ultimate decision that he makes about how to handle this crisis. Because, he's got these Baltimore prosecutors who have come to him with the cold, hard evidence that the sitting vice president is not just a past crook, but an active criminal. I mean, he right up until the December of 1972 had been receiving envelopes of cash. And Elliot Richardson is sort of given this information from these Baltimore prosecutors at the same time that the Watergate scandal is unfolding. And so he knows, in a sense, that Richard Nixon may go down at any moment. It's the summer of 1973. The Watergate hearings are on TV every day that spring and summer. And so Richardson is faced with this problem, which is needing to get the vice president, needing to get Spiro Agnew out of office ASAP, because Nixon may go down and you can't have Spiro Agnew ascending to the presidency. And so rather than pursuing in a full way this idea of formally indicting Agnew, because a trial that would follow could take years, could take months, and so instead of pursuing that, he basically undertakes these plea negotiations behind the scenes with Spiro Agnew's lawyers, including Marty London, who we interviewed for this podcast series, that are basically aimed at forcing Agnew out, forcing him to resign, basically above all else. That was the imperative, above sending him to jail, above prosecuting him for extortion and bribery. And so what's ultimately reached is that he will plead no contest to a count of tax evasion. But the predicament that Richardson finds himself in is a difficult one, and he makes a very complicated choice to seek resignation rather than prosecution on the full charges.
So that's his thinking here, that we could have had an active criminal ascend to the presidency, and he thought for the good of the country we needed to get rid of that possibility.
I think that was almost his immediate reaction. He first learned of this when we told him about it on July 3rd, 1973, and he had no idea why we had insisted on meeting with him. And I think from things he said in that first meeting, that was right away what he thought was the most important thing. Now, his man was a very experienced law enforcement officer. He himself had been a United States attorney in Massachusetts. And he stuck with that all the way. You know, there was, particularly from the three of us, there was a lot of opposition to to no jail. We were all... we wanted Agnew to go to jail, and we argued with Richardson. We didn't just present our views. There were big arguments with him. One of the most wonderful things about the man was in these long, multi-hour sessions in the Attorney General's conference room with him and Ruckelshaus and Peterson, he never once said to us anything like, "Hey, look, I'm the Attorney General. You're a bunch of kids. We're going to do this my way. That's the reason why we're going to..." No, no. He always responded on the merits, patiently, persistently. He never changed his mind. And ultimately, he persuaded us that he was right. It wouldn't have mattered whether he persuaded us or not, but the man was a very impressive man.
And 40-plus years later, any regrets?
No, no. He was right. He was right. The most important thing was to get that corrupt bum out of the line of succession and get him out fast, because who knew how long Nixon was going to last.
We're talking about a terrific podcast produced by MSNBC called Bagman here on Midday. Tim Baker is here with me in Studio A. He's one of the assistant U.S. attorneys featured in the podcast. He was part of the team of three lawyers who investigated corruption here in Maryland that went all the way up to Spiro Agnew as vice president. Mike Yarvitz is the executive producer of Bagman, which he co-wrote with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. She's the host of the podcast. We'll have more about Bagman and the Agnew story when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
The Tonight Show will not be seen tonight, so that we may bring you the following NBC News special report.
Good evening. The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history.
The Saturday Night Massacre took place on October 20th, 1973. It was Richard Nixon in a fit of rage trying to end the investigation into Watergate that his own Justice Department was conducting. Nixon ordered his Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, to fire the special prosecutor who was leading that investigation. And when Richardson refused to do that and resigned himself instead, that sparked a true blue constitutional crisis.
Agents of the FBI, acting at the direction of the White House, sealed off the offices of the special prosecutor, the offices of the attorney general, and the offices of the deputy attorney general. That's a stunning development, and nothing even remotely like it has happened in all of our history.
I'm Tom Hall. This is a special Snowmageddon edition of Midday. That's a clip from the sixth episode of Bagman, a terrific podcast about the little-known and little-remembered story of how and why Spiro Agnew, the former governor of Maryland, resigned the vice presidency during one of the most tumultuous times in our history. It's a story that reverberates today as the Trump administration is mired in scandal after scandal, and the president's disdain for the press is expressed in very much the same way Agnew framed it. Tim Baker was a young federal prosecutor in Baltimore in the early 1970s, whose investigation into corruption in the Baltimore County Executive's Office eventually led to the vice president. Spiro Agnew resigned on October 10th, 1973. The clip we heard about the Saturday Night Massacre occurred 10 days later. Mike Yarvitz is the executive producer of Bagman, which he co-wrote with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who hosts the podcast. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet. It's at @MiddayWYPR. Tim Baker, the big lessons of this, because when we hear Rachel Maddow, you know, describing those events and the Saturday Night Massacre in October of 1973, an angry president threatening to shut down the investigation, encouraging the attorney general to fire the special prosecutor, so much of that is redolent to things that we hear in books and articles galore about the current administration.
Well, it certainly does. It just keeps bringing me back to Elliot Richardson, who I think is the gold standard of what an attorney general ought to be and how he ought to behave. And we were very lucky that he was our attorney general for such a brief period from May 25th to October 20th, 1973. He protected us. He made sure that the investigation continued despite all the efforts of the White House to impede it. And we need that same kind of, the Department of Justice and the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, needs that kind of protection from William Barr today.
William Barr is highly respected in many circles. He served as the attorney general before in the H.W. Bush administration. Are you sanguine about his capacity and willingness to protect Mr. Mueller, et cetera?
I don't question his integrity or his competence. There were things he said in his confirmation hearings which I found disturbing. He had previously described the attorney general as the, quote, president's lawyer. That's not what the attorney general is. The attorney general is the people of America's lawyer. He also refused repeatedly to say that he would do what Elliot Richardson had done as attorney general, and that is promise the Senate that he would release to the Congress and to the American people whatever report the special prosecutor in that case, Archibald Cox, and in this case, the special counsel, Robert Mueller, whatever report he issued. And he just refused to do that. And the other thing, as I said earlier, a big part of his job is protecting the dedicated professionals in the Department of Justice from the vicious attacks, repeated multiple attacks from the president.
Mike Yarvitz, you don't state sort of explicitly the parallels between the Trump administration and the Nixon administration. But there are an awful lot of people who have speculated that one possible scenario, and we should, again, emphasize and remind people that Mr. Trump has not been indicted or charged with any crime. Many people around him have, and some have are facing jail time or already served jail time. But all aspects of his life, his campaign, his current administration, his family business, his foundation, they are all being investigated by various and sundry entities. And there are a lot of people who think that there's a scenario that could parallel the Agnew scenario, in which Mr. Trump is faced with a number of charges and basically obliged to resign in order to avoid further prosecution and jail time. Are you hearing people talk like that? I mean, is that a scenario that many people think is a real possibility?
Well, I think the sort of question of how does this end is one that a lot of people are trying to figure out and ask. And the interesting thing about looking at the Agnew situation is seeing how these situations do end. Obviously, in the case of Nixon, it's a resignation through threat of impeachment. But in the Agnew case, it's something very different, which is, you know, Agnew being presented with the evidence of his crimes and given a choice. You know, either we can prosecute you on, you know, 30 or 40 counts of bribery and extortion, or you can take a deal to walk away. You know, it remains to be seen what the resolution of the current crisis and situation is, but it's at least interesting to look at how these situations can be resolved, have been resolved in the past. And, you know, in terms of the lessons to draw from it, which you were asking Tim about, I think the lessons that I see are that it matters that you have people of principle in positions of power and authority. In this case, it was Elliot Richardson and George Beall, who both resisted political pressure at various points to shut down the investigation or to sort of push it in another direction. But it's also, you know, the ability of federal prosecutors like Tim and Ron and Barney, and obviously we see that today, those prosecutors to be able to work without attacks on them. I think the lesson, in addition to how the situation with Agnew was ultimately resolved, is also that you need these people in positions of power to protect investigations like this and to allow them to move forward without political pressure and without obstruction.
And Tim Baker, another parallel that jumped out at me is there's a debate now about whether or not a sitting president, Mr. Trump, can be indicted. And there seems to be a sort of rule, of a tradition in the Department of Justice that says, no, you can't indict a sitting president. That was something that you all had to grapple with as well, because had Agnew ascended to the presidency, at that point, regardless of the amount of evidence that you had showing his corruption, he could have been insulated from prosecution because he was now the president.
Elliot Richardson, during the Agnew investigation, asked the Solicitor General of the United States, who was then Robert Bork, for a legal opinion on whether or not the vice president could be indicted. And Bork's opinion, which still stands as official Department of Justice policy, is that a sitting president may not be indicted, but a sitting vice president can be.
Let's go to the phones to Jesse in Baltimore. Jesse, welcome to Midday with Tim Baker and Mike Yarvitz.
Hi there. This conversation brings back memories for me because I moved here to Baltimore in 1978 to marry a woman from here. I came from Kentucky. And her stepfather, my father-in-law, admitted with a lot of chagrin that he had appointed Mr. Agnew to his first political position in local politics in Baltimore County. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Baker, if you remember my father-in-law, you may have known him. Are you from the area?
Yeah, born and raised.
Okay. Gordon Tower. Do you remember a lawyer in Towson named Gordon Tower by any chance?
The name is familiar, but I never met Mr. Powers.
Okay. Well, he was always embarrassed by his connection to Mr. Agnew, and I just wanted to call and see if you...
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Well, thanks for the call, Jesse. I appreciate it. You know, I lived in Massachusetts in the 1972 election, and Massachusetts was the only state that voted for George McGovern. So Richard Nixon carried 49 of 50 states. Yet after Watergate, if you tried to find a person who voted for Richard Nixon, you couldn't. There wasn't a person who would admit it. It was really quite something. But Mike Yarvitz, there's a huge piece in the New York Times that was posted yesterday chronicling a sort of two-year effort by the Trump administration and Mr. Trump personally to influence, if not impede, the investigation of Robert Mueller. They quote people with direct knowledge of a phone call that Mr. Trump made to Matthew Whitaker, who is at the time of this call his newly installed attorney general. He replaced Jeff Sessions, who was obliged to resign. And Mr. Trump asked whether or not a guy named Jeffrey Berman, who was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York and an ally of Mr. Trump, could be put in charge of the investigation. Is that, in your view, a direct parallel to what Spiro Agnew was doing back in the day?
Well, there is an interesting parallel in terms of, you know, what we were talking about before about Spiro Agnew's efforts to try to get George Beall, ironically enough, more involved in the investigation, because Agnew and Nixon saw the Beall family as being essentially that they owed him a favor. And what Agnew was trying to do was to get George Beall, the U.S. attorney, in his words, to, you know, to lean in on these prosecutors and exert more influence on them, to sit in on them. Mm-hmm. He described, you know, Tim Baker and Barney Skolnick as fanatical prosecutors, and he was looking to have George Beall, you know, who he thought, I guess, was his guy, to be more involved in the investigation.
And so Mike, we're about to run out of time here, so let me just give Tim Baker a quick chance to make a final word.
One of the things that Trump, the President Trump, has succeeded in doing with his persistent conduct is he has lowered the standard of what is acceptable and what is legal and what is not legal. And we ought to have a higher standard, that return to the higher standard and higher expectations.
Tim Baker is featured in the MSNBC podcast Bagman. Mike Yarvitz is the executive producer of the podcast, which he produced with Rachel Maddow. I thank both of you for your time and for the work on this terrific podcast. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, it's an update from the General Assembly in Annapolis with Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun and a review from Judy Russick of the new show at the Hippodrome Theater. We want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.